I'm at Capitec headquarters shooting another episode of Bank On It with Nick Harris. I'm here with Nick Harris. Thank you so much for being on the show. So great to be here.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. And thanks for the opportunity.
Head of financial crime. Yep. That is a big role.
Absolutely.
And incredibly complex. Take me through your journey here at Capitec and what your day-to-day role looks like.
First of all, sometimes people get confused and they go, head of financial crime. I don't cause financial crime. I fight it.
Thanks right, for
so, clarifying. It's like anti-financial crime, I think, is the most
important thing. You're the good guy, right?
Like, we are the good
okay,
guys, right?
That's good.
Yeah, I've been with Capitec for 3 years. Mm-hmm. I joined from APSA Corporate Investment Bank. Mm-hmm. And Capitec approached me and said they got this fantastic role. And I thought to myself, where better to fight financial crime, which is my passion, than at Capitec, where we got the scale and the breadth to make a real significant difference in South Africa in fighting fin crime. So essentially, my role's comprised of two hats. One hat, I fight fraud and scams and schemes and all this kind of thing, really protecting our clients' money and investments and that with us. And the other side, I also prevent people from abusing the banking systems as well from a money laundering perspective. So things like state capture and those kind of things that we all as South Africans are very aware of, right? My job is to make sure that criminals don't launder those funds through our bank.
So, Nick, you mentioned scale and breadth, right? And I really like that you mentioned that because you look at the numbers, you've got trillions of transactions and data points, right? And, you know, so stats saying you have something like 15,000 credit card transactions every minute, which means in those 3 minutes that you and I have been speaking, you had 50,000 card transactions, right? Yeah. How do you cut through all of that digital noise, all of those data points, so much going on to figure out these are the bad guys. This looks suspicious. These are red flags. Take me through some of them.
First and foremost, I mean, this technology, what we use from a financial crime perspective, has really been evolving, right? Particularly in the last 5 years, we've really been given an arsenal of tooling. And this is really the application of what we call in modern data science approaches, right? And the use of, I hate the word, right? It's a buzzword, AI, right? But let me break it down, like AI from a Capitec perspective, right? And really what we've been using is best-in-class algorithms to really spot what I call the proverbial needle in a haystack, right? So I'll give you a stat, right? Is that only one in 25,000 transactions is either fraudulent or money laundering, right?
Wow.
So in order to spot that, we use a combination of data points, understanding the client's profile, understanding who they're transacting with, understanding what would be normal for a client in our base, right? I mean, there's not a lot of people who are earning more than $1 million a month, right? For example, and suddenly you're earning $1 million a month and you put it into cryptocurrency or gaming or online gambling, you know, that's got to raise a red flag. So we've trained some very specific data models to detect this kind of behavior, which then gets run on terms of our AWS infrastructure, which we then use to spot that needle in the haystack. And that gets surfaced to one of our fraud consultants and agents who looks and goes like, well, this looks dodgy, yes. First of all, if it looks like it's fraud, stop the account, manage it, try to track and trace the funds. If it's money laundering, then make a decision around what do we do with it. We obviously have to report it to the FIC, but really starting to track those and going like, well, what does this mean in the context? Why are they doing this? And starting to fight the laundering side as well.
Now, listen, you've got an incredibly gifted team, a very large team, hundreds of people work here. You spend a ton of capital, hundreds of millions of rands on fraud specifically, and detecting all of these potentially criminal issues. You are fighting against people that are increasingly sophisticated. You know, the bad guys also have tools and they're also getting smarter and they're also one step ahead. How do you make sure you're proactive and you're almost, as opposed to being reactive and waiting for transactions, etc., to happen, how do you make sure you're there before that opening or that risk gap even creates itself?
I love the question, and it's really important to understand that once that money goes, right, in the world of real-time payments and real-time clearing, it's so much more difficult chasing after the
funds.
So proactive is the only way we fight against this, right? So again, we use a combination of techniques, and we've invested significant amounts of money, time, and effort into getting what we call real-time monitoring components. And this effectively allows our infrastructure to look at these streams of data real-time before the payment gets released. We've done a lot of development work within our app infrastructure environment, which means even before the payment actually gets recorded in the banking system, right, we've actually looked at that transaction going, hey, this thing, does this look legitimate or not, right? Is this the client themselves doing it? But the important thing as well is that any good financial crime system works in layers of defense, right? So it means you can't just have one tool in the arsenal, right? You've got to have multiple layers, right? So our first layer isn't even fraud monitoring, isn't even these fancy AI words. It's actually biometric authentication, right? So we use extensively what we call selfie technology, which is basically facial biometrics. So we first verify that it is you that's making the payment, right? That is way more proactive than what trying to predict whether or not the transaction. Right? And that's really reduced our third-party risk, right, where in the past people used to get into your banking system and bank accounts and doing what they want to really, you know, like I say, probably some of the lowest numbers in the market, in the industry, right? We then overlay that with our detection systems, which then alerts us in real time on the transaction before it gets released. The second component to that is, and it was infrastructure that was landed in the last 3 months, is the ability to delay payment if we see a red flag. Right. And this is an international trend, right? And it's actually driven out, for example, out of places like the UK, where people realize it's great to have these real-time clearing systems, but we have to have the ability to slow down payments. For people to say, hey, have a look at this money. You know, it doesn't help that it rocks up 5 seconds later, but it's actually a fraudulent.
So create some friction,
create some friction. And that's positive client friction as well, right? I don't think I'll ever meet one client who says, hey, listen, I didn't like you slowing down my payment for 5 minutes, right? Because I'm actually protecting your funds. And this actually, underpinning this whole thing is this concept of trust and making sure your money is safe. If I don't trust the bank has got my back and that my money is safe, why should I bank with you? And that's 100%. Some of the fundamentals of banking.
Hey, you know, you speak about helping the regulator and collaborating at a level with external parties. You know, South Africa is fighting its way off the grey listing, which has been going on for a really long time. How instrumental and critical are some of the work streams that you are involved in in getting us off that grey list? I'm very, very keen to hear about the cool stuff you're doing in that AML or anti-money laundering space, just to help us get to a place where people feel very comfortable putting their capital into South Africa and within the banking system here.
I think the key aspect for it is when you engage with a regulator, right, is to look further than the legislation. So that's the first point, right? Our first point of departure isn't, well, we should do this because the legislation is telling us to do this, right? Or we're required or we'll be fined. Our first point of departure is, like, this is a good thing to do for South African Incorporated, right? Fighting financial crime, fighting money laundering, right, is a good thing for South African Incorporated. It means we will have more trust in our banking systems and people will feel that trust, right? But secondly is that working within the regulated environment, money laundering is always a network. There's always multiple banks involved. And again, real-time clearing, I can shift capital in seconds between various banks, right? So it doesn't help I have the highest fences on the block, right? And I have the best security systems when the bank next door is going to be the bank with the lowest defenses, because the criminals are just going to go there. So I need to start sharing information. I need to start sharing that intel and approaches with the industry. And that's what we started to do. Now, the reason why that's important for the grey listing is that FATF, who's the international organization who's responsible for doing these grey listing checks and so forth, the Financial Action Task Team, they're increasingly looking for signs of effectiveness, right? So this means it's not just I did the 45 checks, oh, you KYC compliant, well done, but you allowed R1 billion worth of capital to go to Dubai, right? They're looking for that effectiveness. And the effective means is that I need to be able to share intel, I need to get data, I need to show that we actually have effectively stop those criminal networks from abusing the banking system, right? And I can't do that in isolation. So there's been a lot of talks at industry level between ourselves, the regulators, into two components. One is private-to-private information sharing and how do we share those insights? Because I've invested a lot in my money laundering systems. Other banks have done that as well. Surely we should be able to say, well, you know, what are you seeing on that side, right? The main point of departure, though, for that is that we have to be very careful not to debank or de-risk, right? because that's the international trend. People go, oh, well, you know, it's too risky for me, and suddenly I don't want to bank the Gumtas, right? Mm-hmm. So you got to get that balance between that and financial inclusion, making sure we don't de-risk unnecessary, right? And be able to share that intel and intelligence in terms of the laundering patterns between banks with the regulators and the parties who are supposed to take the action on those networks and those money launderers and terrorist financing and the like.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned stuff like terrorist financing and anti-money laundering, because people think about financial crime purely as fraud or phishing or, you know, a little scam. But, you know, these criminal networks run incredibly deep. You know, based on what you're comfortable sharing in the public domain, how have you assisted the regulators in cases extending well beyond simple fraud?
I'll give a really good case in point, right? And the problem is with these, let's call it typologies, we call them, or risks, right, is that they span multiple things. So fraud is always your predicate offense, which means that's the primary thing that's taking place. Laundering means that that's how it washes through the system. Human trafficking, wildlife trafficking, drug running, all those kind of things is the predicate offense, but laundering is how it washes through, right? Now, the important thing for us is to say, again, understanding that risk and be able to take various data points and unpacking it. So one of the good case examples we've done recently is that we've taken what we thought was a purely fraud case, right? And starting to look at those data points and going like, okay, well, here's all these various scams and schemes that's taking place, and it's investment schemes that are targeting the general public out there, right? And people go onto Facebook and they think they can get R1,000 return on shares, right?
Yeah.
If they
very common. Yeah, that's very common. That happens all the time.
And the problem is that your grandmother's got too much time and she's going on there. She's like, hey, my money's wasted at the bank. I'm going to put it into this fantastic platform. And it looks legitimate. When we started tracing the financial flows, we started realizing, hey, but we've seen a lot of these cryptocurrency transactions, right?
Yeah.
And we started to see some, you know, foreign nationals and this kind of thing. And we know there's international trend around what we're calling the Southeast Asia gangs, right? Which is these large criminal enterprises that run at industrial scale, right? They've got hundreds of thousands of people working for them in places like Myanmar and that. And these people are basically kept in these compounds. So we start understanding this context. We go like, oh, this is interesting. This is, okay. So now we start seeing the flow of funds. We've seen it's going to cryptocurrency. We see it's transferring out. And we started looking at, well, who's receiving some of this funds back into their accounts in South Africa? And we started picking up, these are like normal South Africans. These don't look like, you know, it's Pity from the Free State.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't look like a money launderer or a scam.
Doesn't fit that archetype.
The archetype. So we start doing analysis and we pick up from the transactions that, but this guy's actually based in Myanmar. We're like, okay, this is weird, right? Let's see how many other clients we are seen in Myanmar. So we do a whole geospatial analysis, we look at it, we realize there's about 53 Capitec clients that have been in this compound location, right? So it turns out this is actually human trafficking. So these are South Africans, right? Again, Facebook, they get offered a call center job in Thailand. You're going to get $6,000 a month, please come join my call center. Within 1 week, they're flown out, they're landing to Thailand, they are smuggled across the border, right? And this is only information we got when we actually phoned some of the clients who are back from these places. We're like, hey, we see you back in the country. Are you all right? So we realize there's this whole thing about recruitment of South Africans into these scam compounds in Southeast Asia that nobody knew about.
Wow.
And we were able to take that information, pass it over to Durco, who was able to provide those South Africans with assistance, right? And this is the power of data, this the power of using what we thought was only money laundering, combat laundering, to really help the human effort when it comes to human trafficking, right? And trying to get more awareness out there around what is actually happening. So this is this interplay between laundering and all these primary offenses that washes through.
Listen, firstly, congratulations on uncovering that. It's now well beyond banking and more, you know, almost like Netflix series type investigative work. It's also terrifying because it's happening in plain sight. I mean, right now, statistically, something like that's happening. It just hasn't been detected. And it kind of brings me to a really important question for you, Nick. How do you detect as a client something is a scam or something isn't quite right? Because these scams are so sophisticated. I know you've spoken about email scams before and you posted about it. And they look almost perfectly authentic. It's undetectable, virtually undetectable.
Absolutely.
I mean, what are some of the little clever things that the bad actors do that will help someone watching this say, okay, hold on, whoa, let me go and take a second look at this.
And the first thing is that these fraudsters out there are exceptionally good at what they're doing.
Right? Yeah.
And they use a technique, what we call social engineering, right? So they create the situation that gives you undue pressure, right? And that's the first red flag. If somebody's phoning you and saying, you need to do this now, you need to make a payment, you're going to lose an opportunity, and that kind of thing, take a step back, slow it down, think around it, because that actually activates your survival instinct.
Yeah, yeah.
So their whole thing is to get you into panic mode, so you're not thinking logically around this. Mm. Now, you would think, okay, this has happened to people who doesn't have financial education. I promise you, I've dealt with doctors, engineers, and
who have
been defrauded, right, through these various means, right? So the first thing is looking for any situation where suddenly you get an unsolicited contact, there's high pressure for you to act on something, right?
Mm.
Slow it down, think, right? Phone a friend, right? And understand it. The second thing is that that creates a sense of opportunity or a sense of potential loss, right?
Mm.
So either you go like, if I don't buy this cryptocurrency now, right, you're going to lose out on the deal of a lifetime.
Mm.
You know, you could be making 50 million rand a
month. So greed and fear. Like
greed and fear.
Between those two. Yeah.
It's primary human instincts, right? Mm. Greed and fear. So they're either going to play to both sides. Either you're going to go, like, oh, this is great. And then underlying is trust, right?
Mm.
Some of these scams, they can build trust over months of engagement, right? Particularly the Roman scams that we see happening worldwide is that it doesn't happen overnight. They have playbooks, right? They won't tell you about that great crypto scheme until 2 months down the line. And that's a phenomenon called big butchering. So they actually fatten up their victim and gain their trust. Right. So it's the second thing is looking, understanding that opportunity and that opportunity of greed and fear, right? That they will be playing on your emotions. And then to be able to go, okay, well, let me take myself out of the situation quickly. And would this be like, would a bank official phone me and tell me to do a cash send transaction?
Yeah.
Would they tell me, and this is some of the real scenarios. I mean, we've had clients who had victims where the scammers managed to convince them that the only way to protect their money is to transfer their money from Capitec to another bank. Now, if I tell you that, you'd be like, no, man, that's ridiculous. But people have done that in that moment, right? So that's the one sort of bucket around very situational. You might get a phone call. Might be somebody pretend to be SAPs. They found a package with your name in it with drugs in it and that kind of thing. Then the second category is really what we call this the opportunity sub, which is, for example, the business email compromise you mentioned. So there you're dealing with a trusted party. You're in a transaction. You're about to purchase a house. You're about to send your transfer duties to the estate agent to clear the funds for you. Their email gets compromised and you send it to a mule account, right? So that's the kind of situation. When you're making a payment, and it's as simple as making a first-time payment to someone you've never made a payment for, put a test transaction through.
Yep.
Pay them 10 bucks, phone the reception, say, hey, listen, I'll pay 10 rand. Tell me when it clears, and I'll pay the rest of the funds to you. That's my biggest advice to people. Also, to phone your contractor or your vendor or everything like that, get the banking details, say, hey, listen, I just want to confirm it. It helps to be paranoid on these things now, particularly, and to your point, it's so difficult to recognize it.
Mm.
So I'll pick up the phone, I'll just phone the contractor, even as the electrician doing the thing, because they're targeting everyone. Right?
And I'm glad you said that, because, you know, crime is, I would say, use the word democratized, right?
Yeah, democratized.
There's no VIP section. Yeah, yeah. There's no space to say, hey, I've got a doctorate and therefore I can't be scammed, you know?
Yeah.
You see a reluctance from people that have advanced degrees or, you know, high net worth individuals to come forward and report these scams because there's an element of shame to it because it's like, oh, how did I get caught in the scam?
Yeah.
But it happens so quickly, so fast.
Yeah.
On that point, Nick, I know you love the term AI, right? But we're in an age with AI, robo-advisors, digital banking is completely taken over. How important is it for you to empower and enable the humans to almost work side by side with the machines to kind of get us to, you know, this perfect place?
Yeah.
And to add to that, do you think we will ever get to a place where the machines will just completely take over financial crime, right? You'll be able to spot, detect, solve, etc., and make, you know, people like you and I redundant.
No. I think, first of all, is that when you're a victim of a crime, right, and like you said, there's a bit of victim shaming. People are vulnerable in that time.
Mm.
I can promise you, they don't want to talk to a robot, right? They want to talk to something on the other end of the line, right? And so the human in the loop, particularly when it comes to these vulnerable situations will always be important, right? When it comes to AI, I'd love to think we're in an age of Skynet, right? Terminator type of thing for fraudsters and money launderers, right? Because
or for the bad guys.
For the bad
but
guys,
not for
yeah,
us.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, yeah, I mean, that's like Terminator 2 where they come back, but they're targeting, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger's there, but he's targeting the bad guys for us. I know, maybe that's a generational thing, right? But really, I think what AI is going to equip us to do, right, is first of all, AI doesn't sleep. It doesn't miss transactions. It reads everything, right? Unfortunately, a fraud agent or an AML agent, you know, the work that they do on a Monday may not be the same quality of work they do on a Friday. It's just human effort, right? Yeah. There are human errors, right? Where AI doesn't make that same issues, right? But it's only as good as the data it's trained on.
Sure.
But obviously, there's an opportunity there. The second component is I think it would lead to quicker, better, faster decisioning by the human in the loop, right? Because again, you know, you don't want to basically put guard mode on your AI to make every single financial transaction a decision point, and that makes a decision. You want the human to be able to go like, okay, this doesn't make sense. Actually, you know what? They got a pension payout. You don't have to freeze that account, right? But maybe we need to send you some better guidance to say, please put that into a fixed term savings account, for example. The third thing for me from an AI perspective is that you're going to be able to process data a lot quicker and faster and serve up those insights on the client. So if I'm an agent and I'm looking at a client account and whether or not this is normal behavior, you know, is it normal for you to pay R1 million at 12 o'clock at night? Probably not. Right?
Yeah.
I can then take those order decisions and serve it up within 5 minutes to an agent and goes, hey, there's something wrong with this account. Block, hold, get hold of the client. Could be a duress situation. Something may have happened. Maybe they're just making bad decisions at Caesar's Palace on a Friday night.
Which happens. It happens, right?
right. But we can't dictate to people what they're going to do with their funds, right? But I think the opportunity really is that to get human assistance to the next level real time, be able to go through those reams of data, 6 month statements in seconds, tell you, hey, this is risky, not risky, and then be able to take those actions quicker, faster, and better, and more consistent.
But I really like that you alluded to that because it's garbage in, garbage out, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, you put in bad parameters, bad data, and you get to bad outcomes. So a big part of that will be training people, not on AI, but how to use AI.
Absolutely.
The prompts behind it, the data behind it, the ability to solve problems for that, which I think it's so underrated. So thank you for bringing that up. And that's it, Nick. I mean, anything cool on your pipeline, anything coming up that we can look forward to?
Some of that stuff we're exploring is what we call graph databases, something I'm very passionate about. It's a new technology that looks at nodal connections between data, right? So what happens there
is like a spider web.
It's like a spider web, exactly. So you can imagine a network of laundering, right, or fraud, right? These things always happen in a network, right? And that technology helps us analyze the degrees of separation. So have you heard of the three degrees of separation?
Yes.
How far are you away from somebody who's doing bad stuff, right? We found phenomenal results with this. We're sharing this on an industry level because I think that is the way, to your point previously, on the network side and on the regulatory side, how we fight financial crime at scale as a country. So we are in talks with some of the banks around, okay, how do we open up this? You know, how do I see where does my money loop into the next bank and to the next bank, to the next bank, so that I can serve that picture better to the FIC or to the police authorities, that you can go like, actually, this is what's taking place, right? So things like that could have taken months with the statements and investigation analysis can take place in seconds. So I think that's a very exciting thing for us. The second component is really our fight against mule accounts and muling.
Got you.
So we've been developing very specific models to identify bad actor behaviors. We are really combating muling at scale, which is bearing a lot of fruit. And but also it's that preemptive thing. So if I understand that you defraud a whole bunch of people, right, if I stop your accounts and I'll prevent you from doing that, I stop one more victim in the back end, right, from falling victim to that.
That's incredible.
And then also what we've been focusing on is the client journeys, right? So to be able to give you, I don't know if you've seen an app, most banks go like, it's bad to pay this beneficiary.
Yes.
And please click this box to say you know how to spot a scam. And you go like, well, that doesn't really help. So our app team has been developing a lot of situationally aware guidance. So, hey, this is the first time anybody's ever paid this beneficiary in Capitec. There's been some reports of fraud. This is a risky transaction. Just maybe take a second look at it. So it's contextual rich information at that point when you're about to make that payment, you go like, okay, let me just double check those banking details. So those journeys have really borne a lot of fruit, and it really gives clients that sense of comfort that we've got your back.
Got you. Listen, that was incredible conversation. So insightful. I'm really looking forward to all the cool stuff you're doing.
Absolutely.
As a good guy.
Right.
I've never been this excited. About financial crime, right? Like, it's not exciting. But thank you so much for taking time on, Nick.
Excellent.
And we'll keep really close to all the cool stuff that you're building.